White Aryan Resistance calling. White Aryan Resistance calling. This is the webmaster on 6/9/2015, Tears Day. This is a continuation of the book, The Impending Crisis of the South. How any rational man in this or any other country, with the astounding contrast between freedom and slavery ever looming in his view, can offer an apology for the existing statism of the South, is to us a most inexplicable mystery. Indeed, we cannot conceive it possible that the conscience of any man who is really sane would permit him to become the victim of such an egregious and diabolical absurdity. Therefore, at this period of our history, with the light of the past, the reality of the present, and the prospect of the future, all so prominent and so palpable, we infer that every person who sets up an unequivocal defense of the institution of slavery must of necessity be either a fool, a knave, or a madman. It is much to be regretted that the slavocrats look at but one side of the question. Of all the fanatics in the country, they have of late become the most unreasonable and ridiculous. Let them deliberately view the subject of slavery in all its aspects and bearings. And if they are possessed of honest hearts and convincible minds, they will readily perceive the grossness of their past errors, renounce their allegiance to a cause so unjust and disgraceful, and at once enroll themselves among the hosts of freedom and the friends of universal liberty. There are 31 states in the Union. Let them drop California, or any other new free state, and then institute 15 comparisons, first comparing New York with Virginia, Pennsylvania with Carolina, Massachusetts with Georgia, and so on until they have exhausted the catalogue. Then, for once, let them be bold enough to listen to the admonitions of their own souls, and if they do not soon start to their feet, demanding the abolition of slavery, it will only be because they have reasons for suppressing their innermost sentiments. Whether we compare the old free states with the old slave states, or the new free states with the new slave states, the difference, unmistakable and astounding, is substantially the same. All the free states are alike, and all the slave states are alike. In the former, wealth, intelligence, power, progress, and prosperity are the prominent characteristics. In the latter, poverty, ignorance, imbecility, inertia, and extravagance are the distinguishing features. To be convinced, it is only necessary for us to open our eyes and look at facts, examine the statistics of the country, to free ourselves from obstinacy and prejudice, and to unbar our minds to convictions of truth. Let figures be the umpire. Close attention to the preceding and subsequent tables is all we ask. So soon as they shall be duly considered and understood, the primary object of this work will have been accomplished. Not content with eating out the vitals of the South, slavery, true to the character which it has acquired for insatiety and rapine, is beginning to make rapid encroachments on new territory, and as a basis for a few remarks on the blasting influence which it is shedding over the broad and fertile domains of the West, which in accordance with the views and resolutions offered by the immortal Jefferson should have been irrevocably dedicated to freedom, we beg leave to call the attention of the reader to another presentation of the philosophy of free and slave labor. Says the North American and United States Gazette, quote, "We have but to compare the states possessing equal natural advantages in which the two kinds of labor are employed, in order to decide with entire confidence as to which kind is the most profitable. At the origin of the government, Virginia, with a much larger extent of territory than New York, contained a population of 750,000, and sent 10 representatives to Congress, while New York contained a population of 340,000, and sent 6 representatives to Congress. Behold how the figures are reversed. The population of New York is 3.5 million, represented by 33 members in Congress, while the population of Virginia is but little more than 1.5 million, represented by 13 members in Congress. It is the vital sap of free labor that makes the one tree so thrifty and vigorous
so capable of bearing with all ease the fruit of such a population. And it is slave labor which strikes at decadence through the other, drawing up many of its branches with a fearful sterility, and rendering the rest but scantily fruitful, really incapable of sustaining more. Look at Ohio, teeming with inhabitants, its soil loaded with every kind of agricultural wealth, its people engaged in every kind of freedoms, diversified employments, abounding with numberless happy homes, and with all the trophies of civilization, and it exhibits the magic effect of free labor, waking a wilderness into life and beauty. While Kentucky, with equal or superior natural advantages, nature's very garden in this Western world, which commenced its career at a much earlier date, and was in a measure populous when Ohio was just a slumbering forest, but which in all the elements of progress is now left far, very far behind its young rival, shows how slave labor hinders the development of wealth among a people, and brings a blight on their prosperity. The one is grand and beautiful, poem in honor of free labor. The other is a humble confession to the world of the inferiority of slave labor. End quote. Equally significant is the testimony of Daniel R. Goodloe of North Carolina, who says, quote, "The history of the United States shows that while the slave states increase in population less rapidly than the free, there is a tendency in slave society to diffusion, greater than is exhibited by free society. In fact, diffusion, or extension of area, is one of the necessities of slavery, the prevention of which is regarded as directly and immediately menacing to the existence of the institution. This arises from the almost exclusive application of slave labor to the one occupation of agriculture, and the difficulty, if not impossibility, of diversifying employments. Free society, on the contrary, has indefinite resources of development within a restricted area. It will far excel slave society in the cultivation of the ground. First, on account of the superior intelligence of the laborers, and secondly, in consequence of the greater and more various demands upon the earth's products, where commerce, manufactures, and the arts abound. Then these arts of life, by bringing men together in cities and towns, and employing them in the manufacture or transportation of the raw materials of the farmer, give rise to an indefinite increase of wealth and population. The confinement of a free people within narrow limits seems only to develop new resources of wealth, comfort, and happiness, while slave society, pent up, withers and dies. It must continually be fed by new fields and forests to be wasted and wilted under the poisonous tread of the slave." End quote. Were we simply a free soiler, or anything else less than a thorough and uncompromising abolitionist, we should certainly tax our ability to the utmost to get up a cogent argument against the extension of slavery over any part of our domain where it does not now exist. But as our principles are hostile to the institution, even where it does exist, and therefore by implication, and in fact more hostile still, to its introduction into new territory, we forbear the preparation of any special remarks on this special particular subject. With regard to the unnatural and demoralizing institution of slavery, we believe the majority of northern people are too scrupulous. They seem to think that it is enough for them to be mere free soilers, to keep in check the diffuse element of slavery, and to prevent it from crossing over the bounds within which it is now regulated by municipal law. Remiss in their national duties, as we contend, they make no positive attack upon the institution in the southern states. Only a short while since, one of their ablest journals, the North American and United States Gazette, published in Philadelphia, made use of the following language. Quote, "With slavery in the states, we make no pretense of having anything politically to do. For better or for worse, the system belongs solely to the people of those states, and is separated by an impassable gulf of state sovereignty from any legal intervention of ours. We cannot vote it down any more than we can vote down the institution of caste in Hindustan, or abolish polygamy in the Sultan's dominions. Thus, precluded from all political action in reference to it, prevented from touching one stone of the edifice, not the slightest responsibility attaches to us as citizens for its continued existence. But on the question of extending slavery over the free territories of the United States, it is our right, it is our imperative duty to think, to feel, to speak, and to vote. We cannot interfere to cover the shadows of slavery with the sunshine of freedom. But we can interfere to prevent the sunshine of freedom from being eclipsed by the shadows of slavery. We can interpose to stay the progress of that institution, which aims to drive free labor from its own heritage. Kansas should be divided up into countless homes for the ownership of men who have a right to the fruit of their own labors. Free labor would make it bud and blossom like the rose, would cover it with beauty, and draw from it boundless wealth, would throng it with population, make states, nations, empires out of it, prosperous, powerful, intelligent, and free, illustrating on a wide theater the beneficent ends of Providence in the formation of our government, to advance and elevate the millions of our race, and like the heart in the body from its central position, sending out on every side, far and near, the vital influences of freedom and civilization. May that region, therefore, be secured to free labor. End quote. Now, we fully and heartily endorse every line of the latter part of this extract, but with all due deference to our sage contemporary, we do most emphatically dissent from the sentiments embodied in the first part. Pray permit us to ask, have the people of the North no interest in the United States as a nation? And do they not see that slavery is a great injury and disgrace to the whole country? Did they not, in, quote, the days that tried men's souls, end quote, strike as hard blows to secure the independence of Georgia as they did in defending the liberties of Massachusetts? And is it not notoriously true that the Toryism of South Carolina prolonged the war 2 years at least? Is it not, moreover, equally true that the oligarchs of South Carolina have been unmitigated pests and bores to the general government ever since it was organized, and that the free and conscientious people of the North are virtually excluded from our soil in consequence of slavery? It is a well-known and incontestable fact that the northern states furnished about 2/3 of all the American troops engaged in the Revolutionary War. And though they were neither more nor less brave or patriotic than their fellow soldiers of the South, yet, inasmuch as the independence of our country was mainly secured by the virtue of their numerical strength, we think they ought to consider it not only their right but their duty to make a firm and decisive effort to save the states which they fought to free from falling under the yoke of a worse tyranny than that which overshadowed them under the reign of King George III. Freemen of the North, we earnestly entreat you to think of these things. Hitherto, as mere free soilers, you have approached but halfway to the line of your duty. Now, for your own sakes and for ours, and for the purpose of perpetuating this glorious republic, which your fathers and our fathers founded, in septennial streams of blood, we ask you in all seriousness to organize yourselves as one man under the banners of liberty, and to aid us in exterminating slavery, which is the only thing that mitigates against our complete aggrandizement as a nation. In this extraordinary crisis of affairs, no man can be a true patriot without first becoming an abolitionist. A free soiler is only a tadpole in an advanced state of transformation. An abolitionist is the full and perfectly developed frog. And here, by the way, we may as well explain whom we refer to when we speak of gentlemen of the South. We say, therefore, that deeply impressed with the conviction that slavery is a great social and political evil, a sin and a crime, in the fullest sense, whenever we speak of gentlemen of the South, or of gentlemen anywhere, or at whatever time, or in whatever connection we may speak of gentlemen, we seldom allude to slaveholders, for the simple reason that, with few exceptions, we cannot conscientiously recognize them as gentlemen. It is only in those rare instances where the crime is mitigated by circumstances over which the slaveholder has no control, or where he himself, convinced of the impropriety, the folly, and wickedness of the institution, is anxious to abolish it, that we can sincerely apply to him the sacred appellation in question. An appellation which we would no sooner think of applying to a pro-slavery slaveholder, or any other pro-slavery man, than we would think of applying it to a border ruffian, a thief, or a murderer. Let it be understood, however, that the rare instances of which we speak are less rare than many persons may suppose. We are personally acquainted with several slaveholders in North Carolina, South Carolina, Maryland, and Virginia, who have unreservedly assured us that they are disgusted with the institution and some of them went so far as to say they would be glad to acquiesce in the provision of a statute which would make it obligatory on them to manumit their slaves without the smallest shadow or substance of compensation. These, we believe, are the sentiments of all the respectable and patriotic slaveholders, and who, perceiving the impoverishing and degrading effects of slavery, are unwilling to entail it on their children, and who, on account of their undeviating adherence to truth and justice, are like the more intelligent non-slaveholders, worthy of being regarded as gentlemen in every sense of the term. Such slaveholders were Washington, Jefferson, Madison, and other illustrious Virginians, who, in the language of the great chief himself, declared it among their first wish to see some plan adopted by which slavery in this country may be abolished by law. The words embraced within this quotation were used by Washington in a letter to John F. Mercer, dated September 9, 1786, a letter from which we shall quote more freely hereafter, and we think his emphatic use of the participle abolish at that early day is proof positive that the glorious, quote, father of his country, end quote, is entitled to the first place in the calendar of primitive American abolitionists. It is against slavery on the whole, and against slaveholders as a body, that we wage an exterminating war. Those persons who, under the infamous slave laws of the South, laws which have been correctly spoken of as a disgrace to civilization, and which must be annulled simultaneously with the abolition of slavery, have had the vile institution entailed on them contrary to their wills, are virtually on our side. We may therefore very properly strike them off the black list of 347,000 slaveholders, who as a body have shocked the civilized world with their barbarous conduct, and from whose conceited and presumptuous ranks are selected to the officers who do all the legislation, town, country, state, and national, or against 5 million of poor outraged whites, and 3 millions of enslaved Negroes, have shocked the civilized world with their barbarous conduct, and from whose conceited and presumptuous ranks are selected the officers who do all the legislation, town, country, state, and national, against 5 million of poor outraged whites, and 3 million of enslaved Negroes. A comment in here is that even though they are speaking against slavery, speaking against the slaveholders, they are not drawing a black and white line as far as getting rid of the slaveholders that really don't want to be there or would like to get out of it and would like to make a way to get rid of it. So it's not an all or nothing. There's a gray area to work with the whites of that time to end their slaveholder position. Non-slaveholders of the South, farmers, mechanics, and workingmen, we take this occasion to assure you that the slaveholders, the arrogant demagogues whom you have elected to offices of honor and profit, have hoodwinked you, trifled with you, and used you as mere tools for the consummation of their wicked designs. They have purposely kept you in ignorance, and have, by molding your passions and prejudices to suit yourselves, induced you to act in direct opposition to your dearest rights and interests. By a system of the grossest subterfuge and misrepresentation, and in order to avert for a season the vengeance that will most assuredly overtake them ere long, they have taught you to hate the abolitionists, who are your best and only true friends. Now, as one of your own number, we appeal to you to join us in our patriotic endeavors to rescue the generous soil of the South from the usurped and desolating control of these political vampires. Once and forever, at least so far as this country is concerned, the infernal question of slavery must be disposed of. A speedy and perfect abolishment of the whole institution is the true policy of the South, and this is the policy which we propose to pursue. Will you aid us? Will you assist us? Will you be free men, or will you be slaves? These are questions of vital importance. Weigh them well in your minds. Come to a prudent and firm decision, and hold yourselves in readiness to act in accordance therewith. You must either be for or against us, anti-slavery or pro-slavery. It is impossible for you to occupy a neutral ground. It is as certain as fate itself that if you do not voluntarily oppose the usurpations and outrages of the slavocrats, they will force you into involuntary compliance with their infamous measures. Consider well the aggressive, fraudulent, and despotic power which they have exercised in the affairs of Kansas, and remember that if by adhering to erroneous principles of neutrality or non-resistance, you allow them to force the curse of slavery on that vast and fertile field, the broad area of all the surrounding states and territories, the whole nation, in fact, will soon fall prey to their diabolical intrigues and machinations. Thus, if you are not vigilant, will they take advantage of your neutrality and make you and others the victims of their inhuman despotism. Do not reserve the strength of your arms until you have been rendered powerless to strike. The present is the proper time for action. Under all the circumstances, apathy or indifference is a crime. I'm going to pause here for a comment. This that I just read, this paragraph, is very close to the declaration of war, and along with it, the call to arms, which I will play at the end of this reading. And just think that there have always been men throughout history who have said these same words. They're basically the same words. They're just in a different time. But the words are the same. These are the words that draw the line in the sand, like at the Alamo. You cannot stay on the line. You cross to one side or the other. First ascertain, as nearly as you can, the precise nature and extent of your duty, and then, without a moment's delay, perform it in good faith. To facilitate you in determining what considerations of right, justice, and humanity require at your hands is one of the primary objects of this work. And we shall certainly fail in our desire if we do not accomplish our task in a manner acceptable to God and advantageous to man. But we are carrying this chapter beyond all ordinary bounds, and yet there are many important particulars in which we have drawn no comparison between the free and slave states. The more weighty remarks which we intend to offer in relation to the new states of the West and Southwest, free and slave, shall appear in the succeeding chapter. With regard to agriculture and all the multifarious interests of husbandry, we deem it quite unnecessary to say more. Cotton has been shorn of its magic power. It is no longer king. Dried grass, commonly called hay, is, it seems, the rightful heir to the throne.
Thank you, Mike. My brothers, my sisters, from the mist-shrouded, forested valleys and mountains of the Pacific Northwest, I bring you a message of solidarity, a call to action, and a demand for adherence to duty as members of the vanguard of an Aryan resurgence and ultimately total Aryan victory. The signs of awakening are sprouting up across the Northwest, and no more so than amongst the two-fisted farmers and ranchers, a class of our people who have been hit especially hard by the filthy, lying Jews and their parasitical usury system. From the beginning of this nation to the present, the yeoman farmer has been a symbol of the Aryan work ethic, a living monument to masculinity. Whenever I think of the first American Revolution, I often remember that stirring poem about Concord and Lexington. By the rude bridge that arched the flood, their flag to April's breeze unfurled, here the embattled farmers stood and fired the shot heard round the world. Unfortunately, comrades, that poem glorifies a fratricidal conflict. How I dream of a new poem, a poem for today. Out of the valleys, out of the fields, pour the Aryan yeoman horde, their flag to April's breeze unfurled. Thence the Aryan farmers came and removed the Jew forever, forever from this world. Let us not forget, however, that the Levantine vermin are well aware of the dangers that an aroused and angered yeomanry represent to them. The tillers of the soil have always been something of a mystery to the Jews. Cities corrupt. while the soil, the valley, the field, the farm, they revitalize and replenish a weakened and drained mind and body. How the weaselly little city-dwelling Jew fears and suspicions the Aryan farmer. What a contrast in mind and body between the two. I think that deep within the breast of our Aryan yeomanry lies a long dormant seed, the seed of a racial awakening, the seed of resurgence, the seed of anger, and the seed of the will to act. We must radicalize the American yeomanry. We must bring as many of them as possible into our vanguard for victory. The task is not going to be easy. TV satellite dishes are springing up like poisonous mushrooms across the domain of the tillers of the soil. The electronic Jew is slithering into the living rooms of even the most remote farms and ranches. The race-destroying DOMs are everywhere. Allied with the Jews in their attempt to neutralize the Aryan farmer is the ever-present local rural pastor or minister. My personal experience has shown that usually the only organized opposition we will encounter when organizing in a farming or ranching community is from some local pastor. However, the stranglehold that the churches have upon rural America is fast eroding. That stranglehold is fast eroding because the average American farmer and rancher is in extreme financial difficulty. When a man is on the verge of losing his second-generation farm, his livelihood, and in essence his whole life, due mostly to the Jew usury system, he finds little solace in theological baggage from the Levant. I'm particularly encouraged by the success that Texas Klan leader Louis Beam has had in organizing amongst the farmers and independent truckers. He's shown us the way, now we must do it for the Alliance. The potential is there. Working out of a base in northern Idaho, he created an organization called NOFIT, National Organization of Farmers and Independent Truckers. Their slogan is, don't throw a fit, throw a bureaucrat. A Beam, working with actual farmers and truckers from the Northwest, has managed within a few months to reach out and radicalize thousands of these kinsmen. I was talking to a young lady recently who works as a waitress in a large truck stop at Rock Springs, Wyoming. Every time NOFIT puts out a new newsletter, they send her 500 copies. She said they are all gone within a few days, with many of the truckers either joining on the spot or subscribing to the newsletter. The regime in Washington, D.C. is extremely worried about the further radicalization of the American farmer. Fortunately, instead of implementing a program that will genuinely help the farmer, they're responding with massive shows of force and repression. So much the better. 60 miles south of Spokane, Washington, along the Idaho border, is a farming area we refer to as the Palouse. It's one of the richest farming areas in the world. In many places, the Palouse has topsoil that is an incredible 18 feet deep. Along with wonderful soil, the Palouse has a very favorable growing climate. Even so, comrades, many farms in the Palouse are being foreclosed upon. I have met and talked with one of these unfortunate farmers, a kinsman by the name of Ray Smith. Mr. Smith is a large-framed, ruddy-faced man who likes to refer to himself as, quote, a Snake River cowboy and damn proud of it. His father farmed the land he lives upon, and Mr. Smith was recently planning to retire. Let his son take over the farm. Mr. Smith's dreams have been shattered, and he's on the verge of losing his 2,000 plus acres, his home, and his son's future livelihood. Mr. Smith, to his credit, took a long, good look at his problem and how he arrived at so sorry a state. Now take heart, kinsman. What did Mr. Smith say when he came to the root cause of his problem? Mr. Smith said, Jew! 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 Not only did Mr. Smith say Jew, he yelled Jew. His neighbors started yelling Jew. And how did the system react? By sending a plane, a helicopter, a bulldozer, SWAT teams from all over the state of Washington, and 60 very heavily armed deputies to the foreclosure on Mr. Smith's farm. Needless to say, Mr. Smith is now a member of NOFIT, and so are his neighbors. Mr. Smith also travels all over the state of Washington, Oregon, and Idaho, speaking out about the Jews and handing out copies of the Protocols of Zion. We need this man in the Alliance. Radicalization of the American farm movement is also taking place in the Dakotas and Colorado. Last week, I talked at length to a Colorado-based racialist activist who has extensive personal experience dealing with the Colorado farmers. Several years ago, this gentleman distributed huge amounts of WRAs and other literature to farmers and ranchers around Fort Collins, Colorado. His efforts bore fruit, for soon after his initial literature distribution, he witnessed the birth of the anti-Jewish, pro-white Farmers Liberation Army. The feds are extremely panicked about this outfit. The same gentleman also gave me copies of the Primrose and Cattleman's Gazette, published in Fort Lupton, Colorado. This is an excellent little rural newspaper with a considerable circulation, which is geared towards the needs and interests of the farmer and rancher. What's interesting about this newspaper, in this issue, is an excellent little article on the Protocols of Zion. And this issue here is a full-page advertisement for a very anti-Jewish, pro-white racialist organization. The Jews are coming down hard in this brave little newspaper like chickens on a June bug. And it appears that it might eventually fold up, but the seeds have been sown. So, comrades, I have briefly informed you of the potential for our movement, which lies within the farming communities across this nation. We must, it is our duty to, take advantage of the ever-increasing radicalization of the American farmer. The fate of every last white man, woman, and child on this planet lies squarely on the shoulders of us here in this room today. Out of all the white racialist organizations in this nation, the Alliance, and only the Alliance, has the potential to bring us to victory. Through the Alliance lies a salvation for our entire race. We cannot fail. Therefore, let us not only preach, let us live racial economics. Meddling Falls, we are not only eating, breathing, and sleeping, we are growing together as one mind and one body. We have broken the chains of Jewish thought. Meddling Falls, we know not the meaning of the word mine, it is ours. Our race, the totality of our people. 10 hearts, 1 beat. 100 hearts, 1 beat. 10,000 hearts, 1 beat. We are born to fight and to die and to continue the flow. The flow of our people. Onward we will go, onward to the stars, high above the mud of yellow, black, and brown. So kinsmen, duty calls. The future is now. If months from now you have not yet fully committed yourself to the Alliance and the responsibilities thereof, then you have in effect not only betrayed your race, you have betrayed yourself. So stand up like men and drive the enemy into the sea. Stand up like men and swear a sacred oath upon the green graves of our sires that you will reclaim what our forefathers discovered, explored, conquered, settled, built, and died for. Stand up like men and reclaim our soil. Kinsmen, arise. Look towards the stars and proclaim our destiny. In Meddling Falls, we have a saying, defeat never, victory forever. Thank you.
Declaration of War, November 25th, 1984. It is a dark and dismal time in the history of our race. An evil shadow has fallen across our once fair land. A certain vile, alien people have taken control of our country. When the day comes, we will not ask whether you swung to the right or whether you swung to the left. We will simply swing you by the neck. This is war. We enjoin all people to choose intelligently which side they will be on. Make sure that you have the greatest number of relevant facts possible. There will surely come a day when fence sitting will be impossible. And once you have made up your mind and begin to act, the die is cast for you. There will be no turning back. With these things said, let the battle begin.
I'm just an aging drummer boy, and in the wars I used to play, and I've called a tune to many a torture session. Now they say I am a war criminal, and I'm fading away. Father, please hear my confession. Still hear his song.